Okay, now listen carefully to this first sentence. Well, all of this, but this first sentence. Everything I record today is, of course, laboratory material, and it's pertinent to today, but it also means it's fair game for the next quiz. But in the course of today's laboratory lecture, I'm going to be showing you three slides from one of the lecture chapters because they apply to today's material. But it's also because I don't have time in the regular lecture room to get through all the chapters, including those three slides, because those three slides take a while just by themselves. So when I get to the three slides part of the recording, that's also laboratory material, but it's lecture as well. And when I get back upstairs in that chapter that has those slides, when I get to those three slides, I'll just skip over them. But you still, of course, have to know them for the lecture exam. Okay? I want to talk about transport processes that can move things either into or out of cells. And because we're investigating one of those today. There are three major categories of such transport processes. Anyone have any idea of what the three are? Osmosis is a specific example of one of the three categories. Specifically, it is an example of the category called passive transport. That's one of the three. Active transport is another. And a third separate category is vesicular transport, which we'll talk more about in lecture, but vesicular means involving a vesicle, a little bag of membrane like we talked about when we looked at the lysosomes and the peroxisomes. And that's kind of a cheating mechanism because vesicular transport can get things into or out of the cell without that thing actually going through a membrane at all. The other two processes can move things directly through membranes. Although a membrane doesn't even have to be involved in passive transport, which is really what we're studying today. But what is the distinction between passive and active transport? Yeah, different spelling. That's a distinction. But passive and active refer to whether there is a need for an additional outside expenditure of energy. I say it this way because some books will say passive transport doesn't require any energy. That's a lie. Things don't move for free. You have to put in energy to move them. But passive transport doesn't require any additional energy beyond what's already built into the system. You don't have to supply outside energy for passive transport to work. Whereas in active transport, you do. It's never going to happen unless you supply additional energy. The source of energy that drives passive transport that I'm saying is built in is in the form of a gradient, which is a kind of a general word. There are many forms of gradients, like when I use the example of turning on the spigot and the water always comes out in your house. That's because it's a pressure gradient. Higher pressure inside, lower pressure outside, and water goes down its pressure gradient from high to low pressure. Another example would be a voltage. You can measure a voltage with a multimeter by putting the two wires on the two electrodes, you know, in an AC receptacle on the wall. Those are at different charges. So there's a gradient of electrical potential energy. Gradient in general refers to a difference from one place to another of some measurement. Pressure, gradient. Electrical gradient. Well, in today's lab, we're really caring about concentration gradients, which is another form of gradient. But it's still a difference. So a concentration gradient refers to a difference in concentration of solutes at one place compared to another place. And as we'll be talking more about in Unit 3, any gradient, whatever kind it is a source of potential energy. And that's why passive transport does use energy. It's just the energy of the gradient that exists already. You don't have to supply more energy. Okay, now, a familiar example, or one that's easy to imagine, is just throwing a sugar cube into a glass of water. At the very first moment, that sugar cube still exists as sugar, right? Pure sugar. There's a high concentration of solute, which is the sugar at that moment, right where the sugar cube is, and a very low concentration of sugar, namely zero, in all the water around it that doesn't have any sugar in it yet, right? So there's a steep gradient, we say, a big difference in concentration at point A, where the sugar cube is, and point B, anywhere else in the glass of water. And there's also a gradient, by the way, for water particles. There's a high concentration of water where there's water, and a low concentration where there's sugar. Okay, so there's gradients involved for both types of particles. Well, it's not going to stay that way. Passive transport is going to move the sugar particles away from the sugar cube area and into the water. And at the same time, the water is going to move from where it's water to where the sugar is. And eventually you'll have, instead of water and a sugar cube in it, you'll have a sugar solution, right? With solute particles, the sugar, evenly dispersed throughout the liquid. So that's just an example of diffusion, which is what passive transport is. But let me say it a different way. Diffusion is movement of particles from where they are more highly concentrated to where they are less highly concentrated. Which is another way of saying that diffusion moves particles down their gradient. Okay? And diffusion is always passive. It's always a passive process. Now, what might seem counterintuitive or even oxymoronic, self-contradictory that is that diffusion is a directed process, or more correctly, I should say, net diffusion is a directed process, meaning it happens in one direction, namely down the gradient, from high concentration to low concentration. So it occurs in a certain direction, right? That's what I mean by being a directed process. Despite the fact that it's caused by random movement of particles. That random movement of particles is called Brownian motion. So when you consider the sugar solutions you're using today, sugar is the solute, right? Water is the solvent. But there's two different kinds of particle, water molecules and sugar molecules. Each of them individually is moving in a random direction and a random speed compared to the others in the population of particles. That's just Brownian motion or Brownian movement of particles. And that's random, right? That's not a directed process. So what I said might seem counterintuitive is that this random movement of particles ends up causing a net diffusion in one direction, down the gradient. And let me use an example that's really the same thing as the sugar, but I think it's easier to understand if we allow humans to represent particles. For some reason, it's easier to understand, I think. So this is a thought experiment. We're not going to go through with it, but you can easily imagine doing it. If you have a big room, like a gymnasium, where you can put a bunch of people in, and each person represents a solute particle, and since it's just a model, it's not reality, you can freeze time artificially and prepare the people. So you first of all tell them, group in the middle of the room, and I'll just represent that by a bunch of dots. But before you start the clock and let things happen, you just randomly turn each person to some direction that they're facing. The clock is still not moving, so no one's moving yet. But when you get the people set up, whichever way they're facing, that's going to be their direction of travel as a particle. And when I say, okay, start time, each person will walk in that direction for as long as they can until they hit something, right? And then they'll bounce and face a new direction and start walking in that direction, just like particles do. Well, if I do that, and the people are cooperative, all of these people that are in the middle of the mass, it doesn't really matter which way they're facing at all, right? Because they're not going to get very far. They're going to run into someone else and bounce in a different direction and keep bouncing. Now, consider the people on the periphery, the outer edge of the mass. Some of those people will just randomly be facing toward the middle of the group, and so they're not going to get anywhere either, right? They're going to just run into the middle of the group and start bouncing. But some of those people on the edge will be facing outward, meaning when you start the clock, they're going to leave this group of people. That's like a sugar molecule going off on its own from the cube. And the more that happens, they're going to walk until they hit the wall, right? They're going to keep going in a straight line and then bounce when they hit the wall. The more that happens, the more people that used to be in the middle get closer to the edge, right? And when they're finally at the edge, then they have a chance of escaping on their own. So it's all random movement individually, but notice what happens is that the net movement, the average net movement, is away from the high concentration and toward the low concentration. And therefore, if you come back an hour later and the people are still cooperating, they'll be all spread out bouncing off of each other, but there's no gradient anymore. You could measure the concentration at any two points, it'll be basically the same, right? Right now there is a gradient. Later there won't be, though. So that's how random movement can cause a directed process, which we call diffusion. And there was, well, to have net diffusion occur requires two important things. They both have to be true for diffusion to occur. One is that there has to be a gradient, because the gradient is the tendency for, you know, that's the driving force that causes the diffusion to occur. So you can also think about the gradient as being the tendency for diffusion to occur. In a sense, that if there's a gradient, the particles want to diffuse down the gradient. But the other requirement is that if we call A and B the two places where the gradient is measured through or across, the second requirement is that there has to be a way for that type of particle, whatever it is, to get from A to B. So having a gradient is one thing, that's necessary, but if something prevents A from getting, the particle from getting to A to B, despite the gradient, then there isn't going to be any diffusion, of course. It'll be blocked. And that's appropriate for today, or that's pertinent to today, because there are some solutes that are going to be either locked into the cells or locked out of the cells. Starch, for instance, is already inside the potato cells. It can't get out. So there's a gradient across the membrane. That's the tendency to diffuse, but it can't. It's blocked by the membrane. Similarly, the sugar molecules in your bathing solutions is on the outside only. It would like to diffuse in because that's down its gradient, but it's going to be blocked. All right? So there has to be not only a gradient, but a way to diffuse, a way to get there. Now, that is just the simplest example of diffusion because there's no membrane involved. Sometimes, though, diffusion occurs through a membrane. And that's really the most pertinent what we're talking about. It's not like a sugar cube in water where there's no membrane. Instead, you have membranes, namely the plasma membranes of the potato cells in the slices you made. Okay? Some things, some kinds of particles, can make it directly through the phospholipid bilayer of the of a plasma membrane. Other things can't. So depending on whether they can or can't is going to determine whether they actually diffuse through, right? Despite having a gradient. The gradient is the tendency, but it won't happen unless there's a way to get through. Okay, now, everything we've been talking about that's diffusing so far in these examples has been a solute. But of course, there are also solvent particles. And even though it is still diffusion, we give a special name to a special case of diffusion, which is osmosis. Now, osmosis is a special case of diffusion for two reasons. Both of these have to be true for it to actually be osmosis. One is that the particle moving must be a solvent particle, not a solute particle. Now, almost any biology textbook, instead of saying solvent, will say water, which of course is a solvent. But the strict chemical definition of osmosis is that it has to be a solvent. Not all solvents are water. But in biology, the solvent is always water because that, we're talking about aqueous solutions inside cells and outside of cells. So that's half of the requirements. It has to be solvent moving, not solute. But the other requirement, just as important, is that the movement has to be through a selectively permeable membrane. Now that's the better phrase, selectively permeable. Some books will also say semi-permeable, which literally means half permeable, but that's not as good a descriptor. Permeable means that things can go through it. Selectively permeable means that only certain things can go through that membrane, other things can't. All right? So only if the particle moving is solvent, which in biology is water, and only if it's going through a selectively permeable membrane does it qualify as osmosis. So in my original sugar in water, water was diffusing from the watery part to the sugary part, but it wasn't going through a membrane. So that's not osmosis, even though it's water. See the difference? Okay. Let's then take a look at the three slides I was talking about. We can see cartoon of diffusion at the top. Now, it doesn't matter what these orange dye molecules are. They're just some solute. Okay? And this is the same box before and after, or three stages in time. But notice that this chamber is divided into two subchambers with a selectively permeable membrane in between. That's what the dashed line represents, a selectively permeable membrane. And in this case, that membrane happens to be permeable to these solute particles. But at first, the left side of the box has a positive concentration of dye molecules, The right side doesn't have any, so it's a zero concentration. Therefore, there is a difference. Therefore, there's a gradient. Okay, so you've fulfilled one of the requirements for diffusion. The gradient is in place. And since they can get through the membrane, you fulfill the other requirement as well. There's a way for it to get from A to B. So that's exactly what happens. It's just like the people moving away from the crowd. The orange balls are going to move from left to right. Now, individually, they're all randomly moving, which means some of them are going to be moving from right to left. But there aren't any moving from right to left at first because there aren't any in the right. The more you get spread out so that there are some in the right, the more some are going right to left rather than left to right. And notice that as you go through time, the concentration is becoming less and less steep. The difference is getting closer to zero. Until at equilibrium, it actually is zero. The gradient is said to be dissipated. There is no gradient, effectively, or the gradient is equal to zero. And therefore, there is no longer any net diffusion. Net diffusion refers to movement of particles in one direction more so than in the other direction. So there is still Brownian motion at equilibrium, even though there's no gradient. But there's just as much right-to-left movement as there is left-to-right movement, and therefore there is no net diffusion. The bottom is exactly the same thing, only with two solutes, each of which can permeate the membrane. But the important point on this bottom is that if you have multiple different particles, types, each obeys and features its own gradient. And it's not affected, really, by the gradient for some other type of particle. So purple moves right to left only because that's the purple gradient's direction. Nothing to do with orange. And orange moves left to right only because it's going down its own gradient. Particles always diffuse down their gradient from high concentration to lower concentration. Okay. That's pretty easy to understand, I think. Let's go to 11 now and look at an example of osmosis. So this involves water, because water is the solvent. You have to have solvent moving if you're talking about osmosis, and you have to have a membrane. Well, this uses a U-tube, the original definition of U-tube, a glass U, but this one's been fitted with a selectively permeable membrane at the bottom, separating the two halves. And in this case, the membrane is impermeable to the solutes, which are the green balls. They can't get through, but the water can, which is very similar to your situation today. The sugar can't get through the cell membranes, but the water can. All right, and the starch can't either. But let's just do one solute for simplicity. So at the beginning, notice that the two halves are equal volumes of overall solution, but it's really two separate solutions with different concentrations, right? The left side is more watery. It has a lower solute concentration. The right side is less watery. It has a higher solute concentration. Well, like I said in the bottom of last slide, each of these two particles features their own gradients independent of each other. So water has a gradient that favors water moving from left to right. The green dye particles have a gradient as well, favoring their movement from right to left. Remember, the gradient is the tendency, but the green particles can't move through the membrane. So despite the gradient, they're stuck in place. All right, they would, though, if they could get through, they would move down their own gradient, nothing to do with water. All right, so what happens if you let this run is that water diffuses. That's what osmosis is. Now, I'm going to give you what most textbooks will phrase osmosis as. some version of this. Most textbooks will say that osmosis is movement of water from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration. Have you ever seen that in a book? If not, you're likely to if you read enough textbooks. That definition is true, but it makes it seem like it's opposite of how diffusion works. Because I told you, diffusion works from high concentration to low concentration. And textbooks say that water moves from low solute concentration to high solute concentration. That's just basically a backwards way of describing what the watery situation is. Right? Because a low solute concentration is really just a backwards way of saying a high water concentration. Right? The fewer the solute particles you have, the more pure water it is. So it is true that water osmoses or diffuses from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, but it's more straightforward to just say the truth, which is water moves from a high water concentration to a low water concentration. The only difference is that it's solvent instead of solute. And if it's going to be osmosis, then that movement has to be through a membrane. Okay, well, that's what happens here. But only water can move down its gradient. Green can't. And since there's a higher water concentration on the left side, it's more watery, which is another way of saying a lower solute concentration, it wants to move rightward, and it does. And you're not replacing it with anything, so the volume is going down on the left side. And the volume is increasing on the right side because you're adding water to it. Now, it looks like this has come to equilibrium as far as concentration is concerned, because it looks like it's about the same concentration on both sides. It's hard to tell. And that would be one way in which it could come to equilibrium. If there's no gradient, it's going to be at equilibrium. But I want you to imagine, because I don't have the pictures, a different situation. Set it up exactly as you have here in the upper left, except on the left side, pure water, no solutes at all. Now there's still a gradient for water, right? It's even steeper than it was before, but it's a gradient in the same direction. So water wants to go from the pure water side on the left to the solution on the right side. And it will. But let's say half of that water goes through. What's left behind is still pure water, right? It's always going to be pure water, no matter how little is left on the left side, which is always going to be a more watery solution than even the most dilute solution that has some solute in it. You get what I'm saying there? You're never going to turn this into pure water, so the pure water side is always going to be more watery than the right side, and therefore there's always going to be a gradient in place. It's becoming less and less steep, but it's still a gradient. Is that clear? It could still come to equilibrium, though, with some water still being in the left side. And that's because the more water you put in the right side, the taller that water column gets, and the more it's being pulled down by gravity. So when the force of gravity pushing down on the right side, which is directly opposing the water coming in, is exactly equal to the force created by the tendency for osmosis to occur in the other direction, when those two forces equal each other, then it will come to equilibrium, even though there's still a gradient in place. You can see the details on the bottom, though. The green particles are too big to permeate. The water molecules are not. Now, at equilibrium, no matter how it comes about, it's called dynamic equilibrium, meaning that things don't stop. That would be static. Dynamic means changing. Things are still moving around. It's just that there's just as much right-to-left movement as there is right-to-left movement. Did I say both of those correctly? You know what I'm saying. They're moving in both directions at the same rate, and therefore there's no longer any net osmosis. All right. With all that clear, hopefully, let's go to the final slide for this, slide 12, which gives you some more important definitions to understand. And I want to warn you that this is one area where the manual gets it wrong. So listen to me. What I say is the truth. there are three words that have to do with the degree of tenacity. Tenacity is the tendency for osmosis to occur. But there are three levels of tenacity, which you see as headings here. Hypotonicity, or a hypotonic solution, isotonicity, and hypertonicity. Here's where the manual gets it wrong. If you want to use these words correctly, they should never be used to describe a cell. Instead, these three words are used to describe the environment of the cell, the solution that the cell is immersed in. So in your body, that would be the extracellular fluid, not the cell itself. So you don't call a cell hypertonic or hypotonic or isotonic, you call the environment that. All right? Be careful about that, because the manual says otherwise, or gives an example that's otherwise, at least. I can't remember where it is, to tell you the truth. Okay, so there's three definitions we need to go through, but they are confusing as well, just like the backwards way of defining osmosis that most textbooks use. These words were devised kind of backwards, because what really matters as to whether water moves is the water gradient, right? It's only the water gradient that moves water, not the solute particles. But these words, which have to do with the tendency for water to move, are named after what's going on with the solutes, not with the water. So it's kind of backwards. Hypo, as a prefix, means below. Like in hypodermic, right? Below the skin. And so a hypotonic solution gets named for the fact that it has a lower, that's where the hypo comes from, solute concentration than the cell does. There's a separate solution inside the cell, right? We call that the cytosol. The liquid part of the cytoplasm is called the cytosol. That's the solution inside the cell. Well, a hypotonic solution has a lower solute concentration than the cell does. But that's just a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution is more watery than the cell, right? Because having a low solute concentration means it's watery. It's the wateriness that matters here for osmosis, because that determines the water gradient. Since a hypotonic solution is more watery than the cell itself, water is going to move into the cell. Water always follows its gradient. It's always going to move from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. But in the case of a hypotonic solution, it's more watery outside the cell than inside the cell, so water comes in. On the top row, we have animal cells, red blood cells, erythrocytes, just as representative animal cells, which, as we talked a little bit about upstairs, don't have cell walls. They have a plasma membrane only, which is a pretty flimsy device. So in a hypotonic environment, an animal cell will swell up because of the intake of water so much that it will undergo lysis. It will lyse, which means splitting. Just like in hydrolysis, right? It means splitting. Obviously, that's bad for the cell. It kills the cell. It ruptures. So animal cells don't do well in a hypotonic environment. Let's go to the other extreme before we go to the middle. Hypertonic is exactly the opposite. The prefix means the opposite, right? It means above. Hypertonic solutions have a solute concentration that's higher than that in the cell, which is a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell. Well, once again, if there's a gradient, water is going to move down its gradient. It's always going to move to where it's less watery, but in this case, it's less watery outside. So the water leaves the cell, reducing the volume in the cell, of course, so it shrinks. And that shriveling or shrinkage is called crenation, with an N. Also bad for the cell. That will kill it too if it's extreme. So animal cells don't do well in either extreme, hypotonicity or hypertonicity. Iso means equal. So an isotonic solution by definition is one that has a solute concentration, an overall solute concentration, that is equal to the solute concentration inside the cell. Which is just a more complicated way of saying that an isotonic solution is equally watery compared to the interior of the cell. Meaning that there's no gradient for water, right? They're equal concentrations of water. And therefore, there's movement both in and out at the same rate, and an animal cell will be nice and happy in an isotonic environment. You should realize, by the way, that overall solute concentration doesn't say anything about the nature of the solvent. I mean the solute. For instance, today you have starch as solute, and you also have sucrose as solute, right? Your sucrose is in your environment, your bathing solution that you are soaking them in, and it can't get in. The starch is inside the cells produced by the potatoes, and it can't get out. Now, if you happen to have exactly the same concentration of starch inside the cell as you have sucrose outside the cell, even though they're totally different solutes, it doesn't matter. Because if they're exactly equal solute concentrations, that means indirectly that they're both equally watery. They're both exactly 1.5 molar, for instance, then that means they're equally watery. And it's the wateriness that really matters. So it doesn't matter what kind of solute you have, isotonic solutions have the same overall solute concentration as the cell itself. Okay. Plants are shown on the bottom, plant cells. And a huge difference, of course, as we talked about, is that a plant cell has a cell wall, which is much thicker and stronger than the plasma membrane, which it also has. And if you consider the room a cell, the structure of the wall is the cell wall. The paint is like the plasma membrane on the inner surface of it. Well, if you put a plant cell into a hypotonic solution, of course, water is going to go into the cell just for the same reason as it does for an animal cell. But because of that thick cell wall, the plant cell can withstand the pressure. It becomes turgid, which means swollen. And that actually is the ideal situation for a plant. It's not for the animal, it kills the animal cell, but it's ideal for a plant cell. Only one cell is shown here, but you have millions in a plant, right? And when they all undergo osmosis from a hypotonic environment, and they all take on water, they all swell, and therefore they all start pushing on each other, and that really just causes an erection in the stem of the plant. That's what keeps it upright. Very similar to an erection in a penis, only instead of it being blood pressure, it's osmotic pressure in individual cells pushing on each other. Well, if you forget to water a houseplant, eventually the bathing solution is no longer hypotonic because that water's going in and it's leaving solutes behind. It's becoming more concentrated, the environment is. So eventually it'll get to isotonicity, where water's both entering and exiting. The plant could survive that, but it's a flaccid cell now. It's limp, so it's not pushing on each other. The stem loses its erection, which means it starts to droop, right? Which tells you you better give this plant some water, and it will go back up because you're making it, you're restoring it to hypotonic solution. In a hypertonic solution, a plant cell does not like that at all. The cell wall stands up to the loss of water. It's going to lose water for the same reason an animal cell does, right? Because it's more watery inside than out, so water goes to the less watery place. But even though the cell wall stands up to that, you're removing water from inside the boundaries of the plasma membrane, and therefore it shrinks away from the cell wall, like paint shrinking from the wall. And that will destroy the cell as well, killing it. So the ideal environment for a plant cell is hypotonicity. For an animal cell, it's isotonicity. Is all that clear? Okay, that ends the slides, so that ends the lecture part, but I still have some more to say about lab. Specifically about writing it up, because this one's for another report. By the way, I can't remember whether I explicitly said it last time or not, but when you have to submit a Word document, I think the manual tells you you have to do a hand-drawn graph. And that's simply because you have to know how to make a graph by hand. That's a hint for what's on the practicum. You have to demonstrate eventually that you can do a hand-drawn graph. But if you're really confident in your hand-drawing ability, you can use a computer to do your graphs. I'm fine with that. I'm also fine with you hand-drawing it. Whichever way you do it, though, you have to have that graph in your Word document. So if you draw it by hand, take a snapshot of it, insert it into the Word document, and then submit it. You only submit one document, not separate uploads. Okay, now, most of the report is pretty straightforward to answer the questions on, but one thing that just throws a lot of students is what I'm going to talk about. I'm basically going to give you the answer. And I can almost guarantee you that even though I'm giving you the answer, some of you are not going to remember to even listen to this recording, and you're going to do it wrong anyway. First of all, what is your dependent variable today? In general, what is the dependent variable in any given experiment? It does, but that's not exactly the definition. What did you say?
I said depends on that.
Well, that's why it's called the dependent variable. But what's the practical definition of the dependent variable? No, it's the thing that you measure. It might be changing, but you are not changing it. The thing that you are intentionally changing or adjusting is the independent variable. The thing you measure is the dependent variable. So today, what is the dependent variable? Right. You are weighing. Those are your direct measurements, but you're getting a before and an after. Those are raw data, which you then use to calculate a change in mass, which is what your dependent variable really is, the change in mass. So you have to have an initial weight and initial mass and a final mass in order to calculate delta mass or change in mass. All right? And that should, of course, go on, like all dependent variables, the vertical axis. I'm just going to put delta M or delta mass just as an abbreviation. How do you calculate delta mass? Well, it is the difference, but how do you calculate it? There's two ways to calculate a difference. No, you subtract the initial from the final. In symbols, it's delta mass equals mass final minus mass initial. Okay, so if that number is positive, what does that mean? What has to be true for this formula to become positive. I can't hear over this fan. Right, the final mass is greater, which is another way of saying that the potato slices took on water, right? They gained water. If it's a positive delta mass. If it's negative, that means what you're subtracting from final is even bigger. Initial would be bigger, right? That means you're losing mass if it's negative. So is that clear mathematically, first of all, before we go on? The point here, though, is that the delta mass, which is what you're plotting, can be either negative, positive, or zero. So don't plot final mass, don't plot initial mass, plot change in mass. And therefore, it's going to start at some negative number, it's going to go up to some positive number, and it's going to have zero somewhere in the scale. Don't just start it at zero down at the bottom, because some values might be negative. Okay, what's the independent variable? Sucrose concentration. Right? That's what you adjust. And how many different concentrations do you use? What are they? The concentrations. 0, 0.3, and 0.5. I can almost guarantee you that some of you are going to do this. 0, 0.3, 0.5. What's wrong with that? Can't hear you. Yeah, it's treating them like they're categories, like red, yellow, and pink. These are numbers on a number line. And the spacing between 0.3 is bigger than the spacing between 0.3 and 0.5. So don't do this. Make it a numerical axis, because it's going to affect your line, right? The spacing affects your line. Okay, so 0.5 would be closer to 0.3, somewhere over here. Now, whatever your results are, I'm just going to draw some dots here. Let's say it looks like that. You wouldn't expect them to be perfectly on a line because it's a real experiment with some error, right? But you can draw a line of best fit, which it tells you to do. That's not the best line of fit, but you get the idea. Now, what is the reason we have lines of best fit? It's not just to look at. That's part of the reason. But what's the other reason? To predict. Exactly. They are prediction devices. And here's the question on the report that throws everyone. There's one question that asks you to figure out what the solute concentration inside the cell is. And so how the hell do you do that when you're not directly measuring it? How can you use this graph to figure out what the solute concentration inside the cell is? Well, think about how I defined isotonicity. An isotonic solution, and that's what these concentrations are, by the way. Those are the concentration outside the cell. Right? The environment. An isotonic solution is one that has an overall solute concentration that's equal to the concentration inside the cell. All right? And it's asking for inside the cell. So what would happen if you made a sucrose solution that was exactly the same overall solute concentration as whatever the solute concentration is inside the cell, what would happen? The mass would stay the same. In other words, delta mass, the change in mass, would be zero. Now, chances are very good that none of your three measurements is going to be zero for your three solutions, right? In other words, none of your three is probably going to be truly isotonic. But a truly isotonic solution, whatever the concentration of that isotonic solution is, would also be the concentration inside the cell by definition, right? Therefore, you just need to find the X value, which is concentration, that corresponds to a zero change in mass. And you do that just by moving from the zero straight over to the line and then down to the X to read whatever concentration that is. It's not one that you actually used as a solution, but it predicts what solution would give you a zero change in mass, therefore being an isotonic solution and therefore indicating what the solute concentration is inside the cell. Does all that follow? Okay, well then, do it that way if you're interested in points. And remember that this recording exists when it comes time to... You're not going to go home tonight and write this up. But you're probably going to forget that the answers are in this recording. Don't forget to listen to it. Listen to it also, though, for next week's quiz. I think that's all I have. Well, one more thing I wanted to say, because this has to do with points as well. Other than getting your final measurements, which doesn't take long, and cleaning up your potato mess before you leave. If you have a big chunk of potato, you can leave it because the other class can use it. But little slivers you need to get rid of and kind of wipe it down so there's not a starchy mess. Anyway, other than that, the only other thing you have to do is, besides looking at these things, if you haven't already, is to make your whiteboard picture, which I have to approve before you can take a picture of it. This is worth points in the report, though. So each you should have, as it says, three single cells in each of the three conditions. You should use three different symbols, like a square, a triangle, and a circle, for instance, to represent the three different particles, starch, sugar, and water. And you should draw several particles of each type in the places where they occur, inside or outside of the cell or both, showing the relative concentration so you can see what gradient direction there is. And then you can label it with arrows saying which way the water is going to move. But don't take a picture of it until I come around and tell you that it's okay. Then make sure everyone in the group has a picture so you can paste that into your report when you hand it in. Those are all the same.